we've tried to identify major themes in each parsha. Avraham's courage, departure, but only perfecting himself when he reached the bris at the end of Lech Lecha. We talked about, in Parshas Vayera, the great event of Gilui Shechina, the beginning of the Parsha, the end of the Parsha, Vayera Elav Hashem, Har Hashem Yeira'eh, Jewish identity in a foreign world. Avram advancing towards Bris Mila based on the advice of his three friends, Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre. Remember those three? Ricky, Bobby, and Frankie. And we talked about the pendulum swinging back to the domestic and common from the dramatic and history shaping in Parshas Chayisa. So Avram's career has ended. Now the second man comes along, this second great hero called Yitzchak. And before we even start to read his Parsha, it hits us that he's a little bit shortchanged because his father has three and his child has six. And he has only one teeny weeny little Parsha. Paul tells us. Why the disproportionate treatment? Why does Yitzchak get shafted? Where are my Parshios? Where's my airtime? I'm one of three. I deserve at least my portion, my share. And there's only one. And it's not just one, but it's a very boring one. All the excitement and all the drama of all the previous Parshios and all the ensuing Parshios are missing. No angels. We've seen angels in every Parsha coming out of the woodwork. No malachim. They're about to run up and down ladders and escort Yaakov back and fight with him in the night. Sefer Bereishis is a book of heaven and earth. B'nai Nephilim, B'nai Elokim, B'nai Elohim. Nothing. Not just that there are no malachim, there are no milachim. There have been kings and princes, generals, noblemen, important people across the stage just to remind us that this is shaping the future of world history, not just a parochial national experiment. No, one melech, but we'll see. Doesn't really come in full dignity and full attire. Only old friend, now a new enemy. No wars. Nothing really dramatic. Nothing really changes on the grand stage of history between the beginning of Parshas Toldos and the conclusion. It's got a really, really diminished airtime, one as opposed to three or six. Very, very little drama. Not only that, you know the sign that you're an Av, and sometimes even an Aim, your name gets changed because you transition into a new future, and that transition is marked. It's tagged, the marker, by the name change. You're no longer Avram. You are Avraham, Avhamon Goyim. You're no longer the struggling, conniving Yaakov who has to hold on to people's heels and circumvent the reality. You're now Yisrael. You now dominate. And these are glosses for Jewish history. When we struggle, we're in a stage of Yaakov. When we triumph, we arrive at Yisrael. Matovu Alecha Yaakov. When we're Yaakov, we just have these temporary ohalim. When we're Yisrael, we have a Mishkan. Mishkan meaning a more permanent structure as opposed to an ohal. Yitzchak doesn't have a name change. Pity has to stick with the same name his whole life. That one name. And you know what? Not only does he not enjoy the name change and all the honor and awards that come with it, even his name isn't his. Because everyone else was named based on their experiences. Avram, the father of Aram Naharayim, a father figure now, the Avhamon Goyim Vehei, creates elasticity and universalism. It's a universal hey. Yaakov transitions into a triumphant, dominant person from a struggling, competitive. Why was Yitzchak called Yitzchak? Because when they heard about his birth, they started laughing. Some laughed out of joy, some laughed out of derision. Could you imagine if your father called you pastrami? Because the night before you were born, he had a sandwich at the local deli. Or he called you Rain. Because the night that you were born, said, well, what about me? Not about you. How about how you responded to my birth and where you were? Not what my name. Can you give me a name that diagnoses? Remember, names in Tanakh are not just incidental. These are names that carry mission. These are prescient foreshadows. Kalo Shamel Yitzchak Li VaYitzchak Sarah Bikir VaYitzchak VaYomer. He laughed. She laughed. What's happening to Yitzchak? Why does his airtime get diminished? Why does he never get that second name change? And why is his name merely ancillary, subordinate to events surrounding him rather than events about him? But it gets worse before it gets better. Because let's roll up our sleeves and not just take a look from 10,000 feet up at Yitzchak. Look, get into the Parsha. Because at least he has one Parsha. There's got to be something beneath the surface. If we dig a little deeper, perhaps we'll find the answer to our question. We'll find his real genius and his real heroism. This is his Parsha, right? That's what you and I would think. But that really is Parsha. Because he's being manipulated and maneuvered at every turn. And he's not controlling the narrative at any stage. He davens. Even his davening is joint l'nochach ishto. But she's the one who senses the conflict. She's the one that senses the complexity. She's the one that solicits information. Then very quickly it all shifts. Now it's no longer her directing the show, but the two brothers deciding how this Bechorah will unfold. And the Bechorah is really the keystone of Sefer Bereishis, so they're determining it without asking him. And then, not only are people ignoring him, they're going through him without even knowing about it. The first time, they operated autonomously. The second time, they operate through him without his authorship. Because he's blind. He can't see. So what's happening to Yitzchak? The only Parsha he has isn't even his. Well, maybe if we read the Pesukim a little bit, maybe we'll find something for Yitzchak. Ela told us, Yitzchak ben Avraham, Avraham. Oh no. Again? These are the events of Yitzchak. You know what his greatest achievement was? He was born to Avraham. No. What about me? These are the events. Veisha the Yaakov Eretz Megarev, El told us Noach. No word tolda in Sefer Bereishis begins with who your father was. Who your child was, maybe. How you impacted the world. And remember, it's not just a content-oriented statement or displacement. It's also stylistic. It's called enjambment. Literally, we have two words that belong separate, being yoked together in adjacency. Ela told us Yitzchak ben Avraham, Avraham. So you look at that pasuk, your eyes immediately are riveted to Avraham, Avraham. Sounds like the Akedah, Avraham, Avraham. Vayam Rineni. And keep in mind, till this point, this was Yitzchak's crowning achievement, that he was tied down. That's your crowning achievement, that you were a tied, passive person, rather than, come on, give me a role. Give me some role. I have to confess my sins. In second grade, I didn't really pay attention too much. Basically spent the whole year in the back of the classroom manufacturing aluminum foil. You know, make it all shiny. We had aluminum foil factory going back there. Think I single-handedly saved the steel industry in the 70s. And then it came time for the end of the year. We put on Birchas Yitzchak as the final play. And we put it on in Yiddish. And I really knew it well, despite my distraction in the aluminum industry. I really knew it well. But my Rebbe, I guess I can give him a pass on that one, didn't think I knew it. So he gave the lead role to my arch enemy, Tzvi Piatnika. Oh, that created, I hope he's listening now, that created great envy. Well, I got the better because I was a better baseball card flipper by the end of the year. I said, give me a role, let me be part of the play. I know Yiddish, I know Bechas Yaakov, please. I'm a late bloomer. You may see me as just a simple lunch pail aluminum molder, but one day, so I finally got a role in the play. In order to accommodate as many boys in the play, you should see how much food was served to Yitzhak during those brothels. We think it was just one dish. It was an orgiastic buffet, so that every boy would have a role bringing in another dish. So I was in charge of the Farschbeis. For those of you who are Yiddishly impaired, the Farschbeis is the entree, the pre-course. So I came waltzing on stage with the Farschbeis. It was a quiet role, but at least I had a role. Yitzhak doesn't even have Farschbeis. He's just bound and gagged, watching the events go by. Golf ball in his mouth. Oh, not really, but let him have a role. He's just Avraham's son. Well, there is some excitement here. It's not just all he's being passive and being ended around. You know, and I think there are sheets back there for Benji. It's not just all Benji giving him a sheet. It's not all just passive. Because there is some drama to this parsha. There is one single isolated event that it's all about Yitzchak. And there's a king, and there's drama, and there's a famine. So maybe we can carve out something about Yitzchak's personality by studying the famine. Source Gimel. Vayihi Ra'av Ba'aretz Milvad Harav Asher Haya Bimei Avraham. He doesn't even have his own famine. His famine is just part two of Avraham's famine. This is Avraham's famine, part two, act two. Can I just get a little famine here? I'm not asking for much. Not even a role in the second grade play in Kamenetz. Just a famine. Can it at least be Yitzchak's famine? It's the second famine. It's Avraham part two. So Hashem promises him, okay, now this is Yitzchak coming to the surface. Now we're going to get my promises, my bris. This is the only time HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to Yitzchak. Think of all the communications to Avraham and all the interactions with Yaakov, dreams and conversations. And at the Akedah, Hashem through the Malach is speaking to Avraham. Yitzchak's probably eavesdropping. What's it going to be? Yes or no? He's hoping. Obviously, he's hoping for the Akedah also. What's the Mekayim Ratzon Hashem? It's the only time. This is where Hashem delivers the bracha, the bris, the covenant. Hashem tells him, don't worry. Here it is. I deserve this. This is my delivery. Why? Line number 5, 6, Pasuk Hey. Ekev asher shema Avraham bekoli. You know why I'm delivering these covenants to you? Because your father listened to my voice and to my instructions. Hello! When I was Shana Aleph, actually Shana Bet, you think, you have a hard time with your chavrusa? My chavrusa lives in Teaneck now, a very good friend of mine. He's Chanoch's uncle, Eli Berman. Eli Berman's father was best friends with Rav Lichtenstein for like 50 years. Rav Lichtenstein would come over every day to check on Eli. Like you would for your best friend's son when they were in yeshiva. How are you? Do you need food? Can I scratch your nose? And he didn't know I existed. Hello! I'm here! Obviously, not really. Yitzchak saying, it's all about Avraham, Ekev, Asher, Shama, Avraham, Bekoli, Vayishmar. Mishmarti, Mitzvasai, Chokosai, Vesarasai. And then Hashem comes to Yitzchak, this is his one dream. Vayar, Vayar, Lav Hashem, Belayla, about 20 psukim later. Vayomer, here I am, Yitzchak. Anochi, Elokei, Avraham, Avicha. Can you at least make believe you're my God in the dream? Anochi, okay, Avraham, Pachad Yitzchak, maybe? Al tira, don't be afraid. Ki itchani. Nechen averchticha verbeis yizarecha ba'avur Avraham avdi. Okay. That's not going to work. Can't get a dream. Can't get a conversation. Can't get a famine. But at least I could try to save my wife from Avimelech. Let me try to think of something original. How am I going to save my wife from Avdavi Melech? Let me see here. Oh, I got it. I will say she's my sister. flash of creativity. Here it is. Where have we seen that before? So then he has this one encounter with Avimelech. His one chance to show his machismo and stand up to Avimelech and take those wells and dig some wells. Show the man who owns the land. Show this Avimelech. Vayeshev Yitzchak, Vayeshev Yitzchak, Vayachpor, Es Be'eros Hamayim, Asher Chafru, Bimei Avraham Aviv. He digs the same wells. So this is Yitzchak's last chance, okay? Remember, we're about to start the manipulation of Yitzchak through the brachos. No new wells, no new famines, no new brachos, no new names. One parsha, he's got to get something on his resume. Got to get something on his resume. So at least call the wells a name. So at least you'll say, I'm the well namer. That's what I did. I'm a good well namer. So you get yourself a job. Make something for yourself. Vayikra lahem shemos, kashemos, asher kara lahem aviv. So I'm obviously making it comical to get your interest. But it's obvious there's something here. You know, especially when the smoke, there's fire. When there's fire, there's fire. You have to infer from the smoke. And just in case you aren't paying attention, Chazal flashed the neon medrash at you. Source number Vav. Avraham Nikra Avraham. Yitzchak Nikra Avraham. The Chsiv Ve'ela told us Yitzchak ben Avraham, Avraham. So what's up? Who is this man? Why is he so great? Why is his identity so submerged and suppressed? Why is he just Avraham part two, famine part two? And more importantly, what does it do for us? How does it help us? We're not here just for enjoyment, to think about others, but how do these lives shape us? What is a bris in your life? Remember Lach Lecha. What does it mean to be in a secular world but to be proud to be a Jew? What does it mean one day to be a husband and a father and spend time at home rather than bright lights, general applause, quiet domestic? What does it mean for us? What does Yitzchak mean for you? And the answer is as follows. Paradigm shift every once in a while in human experience. When a paradigm shifts, it's called a revolution of consciousness. And it's great new ideas that enter the world stage and shape human history. But every revolution is only as successful as the period of stability which succeeds that revolution. So that ideas that have been introduced to the mainstream, become entrenched, can become commonplace, can become a new paradigm. Revolutionary ideas have to evolve gradually into a paradigm. Think of the 18th century. Revolutions which are still shaping human identity, still 400 years later, for better or for worse. One of the great challenges of modern society is to learn the ills of democracy. Humanity is so grateful to democracy for having liberated them from tyranny and feudalism, from suffering and pain, millennia of death and crisis, that we deify democracy rather than accepting it as the best form of governance man has been able to generate, but pitifully flawed, both politically and more importantly, because we're not interested in politics, but morally. What are the moral prices we pay? I love the conversation in Israel every time the question of whether religion should be introduced, whether stores should be closed on Shabbos, voting issues, demography. And the question is, the headline, is Israel a democracy or not? I'm totally disinterested in the conversation, but the premise of that title is so flawed. As if we're not a democracy, we may as well shut the tent and close the enterprise. Democracy is a salient value. It's the best form of government. It's a form of the bedrock, but it has its flaws. And the fact that we don't live up to the snowy white standards of democracy shouldn't necessarily reflect a flawed enterprise or a flawed government. And many people have realized the political dangers of democracy, as evidenced in over some of the voting patterns that have led to a lot of strife, and whether you support this one or that one, the gridlock that introduced or invited some of that partisan politics. But that's politically, of course. We're more interested morally. Politics should never occupy your thoughts and your politics. Is just one aspect of the human experience. They grab headlines, they seem exciting, but the future of our world isn't determined by political appointments or nominations or elections. Moral energy drives the world. The moral decisions you make, they may not seem large, they may not be celebrated, but they ultimately determine reality in ways that politics don't, in the transient, fading pattern. One of the great successes of the American Revolution was the ability of gunmen to become statesmen, the ability for militiamen to become diplomats, recognizing that after those revolutionary ideas had been introduced into the public arena, now we need time to let these ideas settle. And to be honest, it took about 170 years or so. America first emerged as a superpower somewhere, World War I, World War II. And a superpower's arrival is never simply economic and military. It's always ideas that drive and fasten people to one another and fascinate the world and lends moral clout and political leverage. And perhaps America's losing some of that leverage on the world stage. And to America's good fortune, it was isolated from many of the wars and nationalist skirmishes which ravaged Europe for the 19th century because it was a new world that had that sedentary, tranquil period to lock in some of those ideas. What does it mean to be free, and how do we treat slaves, and how do voting, and the new world, and industrialization, and the Gilded Age, and there's so many streams that flow across, and all this has to congeal into a reality. To a degree, what makes life in Israel so exciting is that our democracy is still congealing, and we're still determining limits, freedoms, legalities. We don't yet have a constitution. In certain ways, that limits us because that empowers the Supreme Court in ways that other Supreme Courts, Supreme Court's job in America is an assessor. They assess whether a law abides by the constitutional law. In Israel, Supreme Court judge is an adjudicator, determines in his own mind or her own mind whether it's legal or not. That's just not too much power to be vested in. Maybe life in Israel is too complex to develop a constitution. There are too many issues that rend us into different sectors. But think about the success of the American Revolution in contrast to the abject failure of the French Revolution. Because the French Revolution gathers so much steam, so much energy, so much revolutionary fervor that at a certain point it just falls in on itself. It collapses under the weight of its own enthusiasm. And today's revolutionary heroes become tomorrow's victims of the guillotine, as Robespierre or Jean-Paul Marat. He wasn't guillotined, he was stabbed. This doesn't yield that period of statesmanship, tranquility. Life isn't just a flash of revolution. Life has a pattern to it. Life has a rhythm to it. And that's Yitzchak's genius. Avraham introduced two bold new ideas to the human consciousness. A God who you couldn't see. A God who you couldn't imagine. But you could love with passion and fear, with trembling. You could relate to with emotions even though you couldn't see him. There's a schism. Gods that are physical can interact with human beings, but they're limited. Gods that are transcendent are distant and detached. Now, Avraham welded the two into one common idea, one common fusion of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Elokei HaShemayim v'Elokei HaAretz. Transcendent and imminent. Beyond and interactive. And that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is primarily kind and generous, compassionate, rachamim v'chesed v'shalom, because humanity had suffered so many catastrophes and calamities that people assumed that God was always angry, that God was always vengeful. So Avraham introduced chesed, and he had to be an agent of chesed to teach humanity that HaKadosh Baruch Hu craved chesed, but unfortunately human frailty carried consequences. It was misinterpreted as divine cruelty. There's simply consequences of moral collapse. Now it's Yitzchak's turn, it's Yitzchak's stage, and Yitzchak's challenge essentially is not to reinvent the wheel. Those ideas have been proffered, those ideas have been asserted boldly and emphatically. Now can Yitzchak just let those ideas settle in and work towards the embedding and entrenching of those ideas. Yitzhak's the first farmer. Nomads travel from land to land, from hilltop to hilltop, and the message fades just as the wagons pull away. Yitzhak's the farmer. Iconically, symbolically, takes root. And that takes moral courage. It's always easier to be a revolutionary. It's fresh. It's exciting. It's bold. I wonder how long it takes until the Fidel Castro t-shirts start proliferating. A man who abused, persecuted, and subjected his country to terrible, terrible hardships. He was a revolutionary. And he smoked a cigar. That's a winning combination for t-shirts of Airheads. Because he's so bold and exciting. Che Guevara. Because he's a revolutionary. And it's too bad he didn't have a good voice, because he could have then been in a rock band and it would have been a consummate rebel. Then everyone would be celebrating. But unfortunately, he had a beard and a terrible voice. It's always more exciting. It takes strength to be boring. It takes courage to act when no one's watching. That's why at every turn, Yitzchak is subordinated to Avram, because that's the strength. HaKovesh is Yitzro. That's the Gevurah of Yitzchak, that it can be Avram's son. Because if he's not, then Avram is probably condemned to the fate which may await Obama. That all of your edicts and all of your decisions were wiped away by your successor. And that will not happen. Yitzchak won't let it happen. He's strong enough not to care. He's strong enough to pull the weight of this new wagon without having to create his own wagon. He's strong enough to be called Avram's son, to be called Yitzchak, to be bound on Har Moriah, to walk in Avraham's path, not to need a parsha. He's a strong person. And that's the saga of Yitzchak. Now this is important to think about on two levels. It's intriguing to think about at a collective level, but it's even more important to think about at a personal level in terms of your experience over the next 10 years. At a collective level, life operates that way in tandem, in patterns. And periods of great, great paradigm shifts and great revolutions are oftentimes followed, when they're successful, by periods of stability, entrenchment. Think of the history of Torah. The history of Torah is an undulating alternation between creative supernova bursts and periods of amalgamation, collection, editing. We'll celebrate Hanukkah in a few weeks and we'll talk about Hanukkah, but the aftermath of Hanukkah is this incredible intellectual explosion, an eruption of ideas, the Tanayim, the Amorayim. It takes about 600 years. And now it's the year 450. And you're a goan in Baghdad. And your job now, or 700, is not to reinvent Torah Shebaal Peh. It's already unfolded over 600 years of unparalleled activity. Now your job is to collect all that work, to find the right texts, to edit out and filter the imperfections or the corruptions, to print them, because this is pre-printing presses. So for 500 years, there's no dramatic creativity that reforms and revolutionizes. It's basically collecting, organizing, codifying, compiling. That's why the Gaonim's works aren't studied that much. Some of it because they didn't survive until we found the Cairo Geniza, the very scattered, partially because now it's the 12th century, and your name is the Rambam. Or it's the 11th century, and your name is Rashi, Ben Shlomo Yitzchaki, or Ben Yaakov Ishtam, Ben Avram Ben David, Ben Shlomo Ben Aderes, or Ben Yontav Ashvili, or Ben Yudak Halevi. Now there's a need to reinvent new models of thought, of analysis, because they used to be intuitive. People would sit around the table and they knew Shas well enough that they would immediately associate three Gemaras. No one dared read a text in isolation. But now it's France, and Jews have wandered, and Jews have lost national pride, and fewer people are studying Torah, and Tosfos has to come along and dedicate resources to reminding us, don't you dare read a Gemara in isolation. V'im Tomar, how could you say this? What about the Gemara in Sanhedrin? The first Talmudic methodology. This is how you learn Gemara. And then the Ramban's methodology. The Rambam's not just Gemara and Torah methodology, but his outlook on life, rationalizing Judaism, and then the retort of the Kabbalists. And 500 years, I'm rounding out to the nearest 100. 500 years, we show him metaphysics, philosophy, Gemara, halacha, responsa, being tossed across Europe, back and forth. How many responses did the Rashba author? 8 volumes, averages about 8,000 responsa. Now it's the 16th century, and your name is Yosef, and your last name is Cairo. And just to write another Chiddush won't advance. Now it's time to collect and collate and organize and rank and paskin and contour and shape. And who do we hold like? Who do we hold like? 100 years ago, you don't have to hold like anyone. You lived in France? Make Kiddush like the Rabbeinu Tam. You lived in Vienna? Make Kiddush like the Rabbeinu Yitzchak's Masara, the Arzara. Lived in Spain? You probably followed either the Rambam or the Ramban. No one way to make Kiddush. Well, they're all legit. But now, masses of Spanish Jews are migrating across Europe into France, into Eastern Europe, course, as far east as Eretz Yisrael and Tzfat. And now everything's becoming disoriented. Oh, you make Kiddush that way. Are you crazy? We've been making Kiddush here in France for hundreds of years, like Rabbeinu Tam, and you dare. We've been taking Lulav. We've been saying Avinu Malkeinu and Shabbos Azer Semei Tshuva. We've been done. Not only that, but I was a printing press. And now every Tom, Dick, and Harry is printing their halachic works. It used to be only the authoritative versions got subsidies. It was immensely, exorbitantly expensive to publish works. So only the real Talmidei Chachamim, only the top, the high caliber people were awarded these subsidies. Now you want to write a sefer, come out with your own sefer. So Rabbi Yosef Cairo says, I've got to collect and compile and associate. And then there's a great man, probably, who lived Yitzchak's drama. In my opinion, more than anyone that I've ever heard of. His name was Moshe. I like the name. And he lived in Krakow. And here's Moshe Yisraelin. He was a Ramah. And he had been quietly preparing his Shulchan Aruch. But Yosef Cairo put out his Shulchan Aruch first. 999 people out of 100 would have said, okay, here's my Shulchan Aruch. That's for the Ashkenazim. That's for the Sephardim. That's for the Ashkenazim. If Moshe knew, if you put out a Shulchan Aruch for the Ashkenazim, it's just going to splinter and bifurcate world Jewry even more. So instead of putting out my own table of laws, I'm going to put out a tablecloth for Ashkenazim to eat on the table of Sephardi Halacha. Because a lot of it is the same, but and he called the sefer for the Baal HaMapa. He called the sefer for the Mapas HaShulchan. You know what type of heroism that is? To reduce your work just to make yourself anonymous, almost. Make yourself Hagah. You're Mr. Hagah. Sounds like Yitzchak. Sounds like Rachel. Those are the true people of strength in this world. And for 200-300 years, all people do is, how do we make sense of the Shulchan Aruch? How do we? Do you know the most impressive sefer written on Gemara in the 17th century? You don't. I'll tell you, I think I actually have the sefer. I don't know how I have it, but I have it. I think. Maybe I opened it once or twice because it's a cool name. The most important sefer written on Gemara in the 17th century was the Kikayon de Yonah. Huh? Because everyone was writing on the Shulchan Aruch. Late 16th century, so Magen Avraham, Taz, Shach. Everyone's writing on the Shulchan Aruch because that's dominated. That's the sefer now. We're at the stage where we just have to, what did the Shulchan Aruch mean? And what did he get this is Diak and the Rashba right? Maybe the Sikri and the Rambam. Didn't forget these Rishonim. The Shach argues. And now, it's the late 18th century, early mid-19th century. All that work has been accomplished. But somehow, people are working. It's so easy for them to learn Gemara again. For some reason, they're stuck in this world called Pilpul, which is a very sophisticated, but logic just turns in on itself. And it's redundancies and contingencies. And they're not really, really getting down to what is Ratzon Hashem? What is Ma'amer? What is Kotzer? What is Migo? What is Ashtar? Don't give me. If you say this, and you say this, and you say this, and you say this, then it's not the answer. So Chaim, in the great Rosh Hashiva, the great year of the Rosh Hashivas, come, it's about 150 years. Living at the tail end of it, Rav Mechatchin, institutionalized concepts. Now if you ask me, we're in the post-Brisker era. What's the most important sefer published in the 20th century? I'll give you a hint. Two most important svarim. Kehati and Artscroll. Those are the two. If you want to know bang for your buck, svarim responsible for most Torah learned by a mile. Kehati and Artscroll. Big chidushim? No, just collecting, organizing in different ways for people to learn, and now we're not scrolling the channel, all the equivalents. Look at your watch. It's now 6:58. There's just been another sefer published in Bnei Brak by some great Talmud Chacham sitting and learning Shas Yomam Valayla. And it's basically taking all the Brisker Torah of the last 150 years and organizing it, applying it. What do the Bukhanim say? What do the Chaim say? What do the Brisker Rav say? How does it relate to the Bnei Yoshua? I love it. I love reading it when I get a moment. But no one's reinventing Brisker. It's applying it. And then Chazasher, they're great svarim, one after another. But so Torah also has that rhythm of going through different stages. Let's move away from history, historiography. Let's move towards experience, towards whom you are. Because these are years of exciting, dramatic change. They have to be. We've said that word so many times. So many times. I remember once interviewing a boy for yeshiva, and I asked him, what are your plans? I meant yeshiva, college, maybe. He said, well, I plan to go to yeshiva for 2 years, and then go to college, and then become a doctor, and then move to this town. He took me through age 85. I said, okay, I only asked for the first quarter. You don't have to tell me who scores the final pass. You have to change. Can't be trapped by whatever preconceived notions you dreamed up. Hope they've been infantilized at this stage. Because you see, they were the product of a very, very narrow set of variables in which you saw the world clear because you saw it narrow. And now the stack has been blown off and you see, wait, there are a lot of things that I either didn't see or didn't see with enough importance, and hopefully it's progressional and developmentally sound. It's not indoctrinated into you, and it's not impetuous, but it's real and honest and courageous. If these things are important to me, then they should be important to base my life. The second you walk down the road of cowardice, it's very, very hard to turn around. The second you start compromising ideals for convenience, it's very hard to turn around. Compromise after compromise after compromise. It's not a life to live, so you have to live ideals balanced with reality and pragmatism, but you never want to train yourself to be someone who just again and again flinches in the face of compelling ideals simply because they're different or new. And that's not just a religious statement. These are exciting years. I dream for these years. I remember what I felt like. When I was your age, 18 and 20, you feel like you have wings and you're soaring above and you're expanding your horizons and you're meeting people and you're taking it in. And it's a fresh, exciting time to be alive. But there are also times that you're more sedentary and more quiet and just more repetitive. I hate to say it, more boring. And sometimes it's a question of stages in life. Actually, obviously now the accent is a lot more on revolutionary ideas and later on in life. And some people have a hard time making that transition. We call them Peter Pans. They're always Peter Pans. They can't become an adult until later stages. And unfortunately, that lack of condensation and focus and concentration debilitates real growth. And sometimes it's just at a micro level. Sometimes it's not just, oh, from 18 to 28, I'll be Avram. From 28 to 50, I'll be Yitzchak. Sometimes it's just knowing, even within a particular phase of your life, what is called for that phase. I would say you're probably in a pretty clearly, distinctly Yitzchak phase of your year. If you want to think about Avram and Yitzchak and superimpose it on your year, remember the freshness of Elul. Remember how tired you were during Elul. Remember how things were exciting and fresh and exploratory and red. Everything was just... A lot of people don't make it into Kislev and Shvat and Mr. Elul, Mr. Tishrei. They win Tishrei, they win Elul. They don't win Shvat. Because Shvat is a Yitzchak feel. Shvat is just... Every day feels like the last day. When's the next tish? When's the next kumzitz? When's the next trip? When's the next, maybe 2 weeks away, 3 days are the same. Learning's the same. Your seat's the same. So it's not just on the broad brush strokes about where I am in life. For some people, it's important as well. It's about learning yourself and learning that mixture of Avram and Yitzchak and learning that there are times in your life where it's just taking ideas that you've established a lot of times, and this is in no way meant on a personal level, but I see this, and maybe you may say not personal, but for the group. One of the great advantages of this yeshiva, remember every advantage also has a deficit. There's no free lunch in life. And real growth means understanding opportunities, but detecting the dangers. So a great opportunity in this yeshiva is to switch to your. It's not stagnant, it's not static, it's Baruch Hashem. But so many people, I say this out of sadness because I look back, so many people get trapped by that dibbuk or that genie. First of all, they spend half the year thinking about what you're to be in. You could be in Idshir, the Arab worker, and you do better if you just don't think about which year to go to. Then, oh, should I go to this year? Should I go to this year? Should I move? Is it time for me to transfer? How come he moved? Or am I crazy? Or am I learning delayed? If he moves and I'm not moving? Sometimes it just occupies people's minds, and I just wish we were in the other yeshiva where no one moved. And also because sometimes people move, especially when it means moving to an Israeli shir, because of the appeal of being an Israeli shir. But keep in mind, the Israelis are here for 5 years. And their whole pace and growth is very different. If an Israeli boy doesn't come to Minyan in the morning, he'll be here for 5 years. He's going to the army. I'm not justifying the behavior. If you're not in Minyan tomorrow, woo, 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 so the bells and whistles, sirens. It could be that in 5 months, you'll be in a secular campus. And you'll need the muscle memory to go to Minyan on time and in 20 years. So this is your last chance. Every day is worth a year of effort. So you can't not come to Minyan for a day without us noticing, thinking, whatever. And ditto with how frequent the shir is and the supervision and the second move to an Israeli shir. It's almost like you're acting because they're on one developmental pace and the shirim are reflecting that and you're totally different developmental pace. So I'm not saying when you should move or not, but just think about that. And finally, and related to Yitzchak, I get this all the time. Rebbe, I know what you're doing now in Shir. I can predict the Shir. Yes! That's the purpose of the Shir. To give you the skills. Now do it for 3 months. Now really internalize it and special. Now it's an expertise. Yes! My point is not to blow you away with my Chidushim. Thank you! You're getting the Shir. Remember when I first arrived in Israel? I didn't have a job yet, so I applied for a job in a women's institution. And they gave me the hardest blot I ever had to teach. Chaf Chasim Idarim. This was my interview. I really wanted the job. I sweated and labored maybe a week over the shiur, taking this complex, difficult sugya and simplifying it. And I gave what I thought was a great shiur, and I didn't get the job. So I walked into the administration. I said, okay, I didn't get the job, no hard feelings, but I just, can you give me some positive feedback? Just tell me why I didn't get the job so I can know better for next time. They said, that was the clearest, simplest shiur the girls ever heard. I said, and therefore, sometimes people want to go to a shiur. Oh, wow, I didn't understand a word he was saying. He must be the Gadol Hador. Wow, that's mind-blowing. I can never imagine those words. You walk out of a shiur, wow, I knew that. Yes, that's what real education is, to enable self-discovery, to equip you with the tools. That's what everybody's being successful. So it percolates along a range of different questions in your life. Micro, macro, specific issues, day to day. If you want to be great, you need to repeat your steps day in, day out. Greatness does not lie on the road of revolutionary creative activity. Greatness is always a product of discipline, tenacity, stamina, perseverance, resilience, and the willingness to be bored. I can't say it any simpler than that. And we're all products of a world that's afraid of its boredom. So the opiate is entertainment. If we can just entertain ourselves enough, we don't have to think about reality or identity. So let's just have video on demand, sports on demand, internet access on demand. And I'm not telling you you should smash your cell phones. I'm just saying, don't be afraid to be bored. Boredom sometimes, not boredom that drives you out of your mind or that stresses you. But boredom reflects the fact that you're just repeating your steps and you're walking in place and you're on the road to excellence. That's where Yitzchak comes in. Yitzchak has the strength of character not to grab the limelight, not to be the revolutionary, not to have a name, not to change his name, not to need angels or kings, wars or famines, promises and covenants, names and wells. He's perfectly happy being Abraham's son. Flip it around. You all have great dreams in your life. You all want to accomplish great things. What if I told you that you were placed on this earth to be the father of your son? Would it change your excitement about your life? What if Hashem programmed this world and gave you what he gave you, the potential and the talent and the opportunity, so that your son would then be fill in the blank, flipping around Avraham Yitzchak? You'll be known as the father of, and you'll lead a heroic life working so hard so that you set the table for the next person. Would that make you any less excited or inspired to live that life? If it does make you less inspired, I imagine it does, because we all have egos. We have to work at our egos. If you really are interested in Kvod Shamayim, do you have to be the one giving shiur? Or is it just as, you're just as happy if someone else gives the shiur or accomplishes? Is it about you? Or is it about the idea and the success? In Yitzchak's example, it's pretty clear. It's not about him. He doesn't need it. He's perfectly happy and content. And that's why the Torah draws it in such broad strokes. Eila told us, Yitzchak ben Avraham, Avraham holy is Yitzchak. Well, it looks like we're out of time. I'm not going to say something in 2-3 minutes. Mirtz Hashem, we will reconvene in 2 weeks from now, Parshas Vayishlach, but we're going to discuss Parshas Vayetze. Because it's a super important message that they say, and puts all these messages to shame. It's the most important parsha, so please everyone come Wednesday, December 13th. 14th.